This is the Law and the Future of War podcast, brought to you from the University of Queensland Law School. Through conversation with experts in technology, law and military affairs, this series explores how international law regulates new military technologies.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm Simon McKenzie, a research fellow at the UQ Law School. Today we'll be discussing the Nuclear Ban Treaty, what it is, who's signed up, and why it is important. We're also going to explore what it means for Australia and whether it can sign up and continue to support US nuclear policy. Our guides to the treaty and what it means are Dr. Monique Cormier and Dr. Anna Hood. Monique is a lecturer at the University of New England, and Anna is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. They've both written on the Nuclear Ban Treaty, so are very well placed to help us better understand how it works. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Simon.
Thanks so much for having us.
So, what is the Nuclear Ban Treaty?
Okay, so the Nuclear Ban Treaty, the official name is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It's a comprehensive multilateral treaty, which means it's open to any and all states, and the ultimate aim would be for it to be a universal treaty with as many states as possible adhering to the ban on nuclear weapons. And with all treaties, once a state signed and ratified it, it becomes a party to the treaty and it is bound by its terms. And so the terms of this particular treaty are really quite extensive. So just in Article 1 alone, it forbids states from developing, testing, producing, manufacturing, acquiring, possessing, stockpiling, transferring, receiving, using or threatening to use, as well as sort of stationing and installing any nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices. And it also prevents states, parties from assisting or encouraging other states to do any of those things. So it really is this kind of comprehensive ban on any kind of nuclear weapon or nuclear explosive device.
Thanks, Monique. So it really is, it covers the ground of little nukes, big nukes.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing it sort of allows for is peaceful nuclear purposes, sort of nuclear medicine and that kind of thing. But it's really a comprehensive ban on any kind of weapon or explosive device.
So who's signed up to the treaty so far? What are the collection of countries that are involved?
So there are now 50 states that have actually signed up to the treaty. Nauru, Jamaica and Honduras actually all ratified close together at the end of last month. And so 50 ratifications is the requirement for the treaty to enter into force. So that it will now enter into force 3 months from those ratifications. So that'll be about the 25th of January. And of the 50 states' parties, probably the biggest block of countries comes from Central and South America, but there are also quite a few of the Pacific Island nations, including New Zealand, a handful of African countries, including South Africa, and a group of Asian countries, including Malaysia. Very few European states, and perhaps not surprising at this juncture, none of the nuclear weapon states themselves or their allies. Just sort of for people to understand, those states that do have nuclear weapons are US, UK, China, France, Russia, Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. And Australia, of course, is a close ally of the US and has so far refused to consider joining the Nuclear Ban Treaty.
So given these nuclear weapon states haven't signed up, I think an obvious question is, what's the point of a treaty banning nuclear weapons if the people that have them aren't going to join it?
It's a really good question. And at first blush, it might seem like it's pretty pointless because obviously, as Monique said, the obligations in the ban treaty don't apply at the moment to the nuclear weapon states until they or unless they decide to sign up. However, I think with lots of international law treaties, it's important not to just look at what's happening at any one moment in time and who's signed up and who hasn't signed up. Because actually, if we look at some other treaties, especially treaties in the disarmament sphere, we can see that on a number of occasions, even though they haven't been particularly widely ratified, they have actually created a norm in the international system that most states tend to abide by whether they've signed up or not. So to give you an example, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was created in the early to mid-90s and prohibits countries from testing nuclear weapons in any way. That has never entered into force. It hasn't had enough countries sign up to it to make it legally binding, and a lot of the nuclear weapon states have not signed it. However, nuclear testing today is virtually a thing of the past. We do occasionally have some tests from North Korea, but outside of that, most countries seem to have accepted that they shouldn't be participating in nuclear testing. So even though that treaty isn't in operation, it has created a norm that lots of states get in behind. So the hope is that maybe with the ban treaty, it will have a similar effect, that actually, although not everyone signed up, it will start creating a norm that everybody adheres to. I think the other thing to say about this is that it provides a bit of a pathway for how we might get to eventual nuclear disarmament. And so although not everyone's on board at the moment, it's set up a possible way forward. And the hope is that over time, some of the nuclear weapon states may start to feel pressure or may start to reevaluate their position. And when they do that, this will be an option for them to consider for starting to working towards getting rid of their nuclear weapons.
Thanks, Anna. That's some really interesting points there. And particularly, I think about how international law operates in some different ways to what we used to in the domestic space. When a law is made, it kind of becomes binding, whereas it feels like, say, with a nuclear ban treaty, it's beginning a conversation or trying to create a world through making the law rather than the law reflecting what's happening. So I wondered how it compares to other disarmament treaties. And you mentioned this a little bit, but are other disarmament treaties as broad as the nuclear ban treaty?
It's actually not dissimilar to the other weapons ban treaties, like the Chemical Weapons Convention and the Biological Weapons Convention, although the list of activities that is prohibited in the nuclear ban treaty is longer than those other conventions. And the nuclear ban treaty also includes some requirements on victim assistance and environmental remediation, which is really also a welcome addition. There are also some other differences with sort of verification schemes and things like that, but the drafters of the nuclear ban treaty definitely did borrow some elements from those other weapons ban treaties as well.
Thanks, Monique. So perhaps we could turn to some of the history of the nuclear ban treaty, because I think it's really interesting how it came to be. So who led the efforts to ban nuclear weapons?
So I think when we're thinking about the history of banning nuclear weapons, it's really important to acknowledge that there has been a huge amount of work in this area for decades and decades and decades. In fact, right from the very get-go of the UN, there have been efforts to try and abolish nuclear weapons. And over the last 75 years, many, many, many different countries, different individuals, different civil society groups have put forward different ideas and different initiatives to try and get us to a point where we can achieve nuclear disarmament. While there's been a long history and lots of different things happening, I think one way of thinking about the most immediate history for the ban treaty and sort of what really got things going in the last few years, it probably takes us back to around 2010, 2011. And at that stage, we had a number of different actors in the international scene starting to really push for some form of ban treaty. So we had the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movements advocating for action in the nuclear sphere. We also had a number of different civil society organisations really ramping up their advocacy efforts for a ban treaty. And there are a number of states as well who, many of them have been involved in this area for a long, long time, starting to really push and say, we need to get serious about some sort of ban treaty. And the way that all these different groups sort of came together and mobilised to get some action happening was they held a series of humanitarian conferences in 2013 and 2014, where they got together and they talked about and had presentations on the humanitarian impact that nuclear weapons have. So they focused in particular on the harm that weapons can do to humans, but also the harm that they can do to the environment. And the aim of these conferences was to really highlight just how destructive and problematic nuclear weapons are, and to try and get that that understanding to build momentum to try and get action in this space. And I think traditionally, when we've been talking about nuclear weapons, there's often been a lot of emphasis on the need to have some nuclear weapons for security reasons. And there was this real push to try and emphasize the humanitarian side and shift some of that conversation to get the momentum building. So that was happening around 2013, 2014. Then towards the end of 2016, the General Assembly voted to begin negotiations on the Van Treaty. And across the first half of 2017, we had another number of different negotiations that culminated in New York in mid-2017, where the treaty was drafted and came into being.
So perhaps something good to come out of 2016.
And there was a particularly miserable year in many respects, right? But yes, it definitely ended well towards Christmas, getting that vote to start negotiations. It was very good.
So was it expected at the beginning of the negotiations that they would come up with a treaty, or was it a surprise as you as an observer looking at it? Did you think this was the outcome that was likely?
That's a really good question. I think definitely some of the key players were adamant that they were going to get a treaty put in place. And I know that some of the different ministries of foreign affairs and departments of foreign affairs that were involved in drafting this were very, very clear that they were going to make it happen. I have to say at the outset when I was, I can remember talking about this in about February 2017 and being quite sceptical that within just the space of a few months, which for the UN is very fast, we would see a treaty. But I was proved wrong, and it did come into being as a lot of those who were really in the room were hoping it would.
And so now it's coming into force, or will come into force in early January next year with the 50 ratifications, as Monique said.
That's right.
Are you surprised that it's being ratified that quickly, or do you think that's the sort of time frame you would normally expect?
I don't know if we can talk about any sort of normal at the moment in the international system, because there's so many different moving parts. And in the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen so many different dynamics emerge. But I think there's been some really concerted efforts by both civil society, and in particular ICANN, as well as different states, to try and encourage countries to come on board. And so I think given the level of discussion and effort and energy put into trying to get states to come on board, it's probably not that surprising that we've managed to get it to happen just within a few years. I think also the nuclear arena is an area that many states do care a huge amount about. And so there have been a number of states that have been really keen to see action on this for a very long time.
And if I could just add to that as well, 50 states for ratification is not a huge number. So I think that was always a fairly realistic prospect that we were going to get 50 states ratifying in a relatively short amount of time.
You just mentioned, Anna, there, the organisation ICANN. I wondered if you could just briefly explain what that is and the role that they've played.
So ICANN stands for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and it's a global civil society organisation that's worked really hard now for a number of years to try and get action happening on nuclear disarmament. So one of the things that they fought particularly hard for was this Ban Treaty, and they were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts in bringing it to fruition. And since we got the text of the treaty in 2017, they've been one of the groups that's been working really hard to encourage states to sign on and ratify the treaty.
Thanks, Anna. So they're a sort of important organisation to be thinking about when we look at the campaign to support the treaty.
Yeah, they were one of the key players involved.
So, Monique, the nuclear ban treaty, obviously links to an earlier treaty, the non-proliferation treaty. I wondered if you could talk a bit about the connection between the two treaties.
Yeah, so the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT, it's a long-standing multilateral treaty that entered into force back in 1970. And the aim of that treaty is to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and to further the goal of achieving nuclear disarmament. And so the NPT has a lot more state parties. It has 191 at the moment states parties, including the original nuclear weapon states, but it doesn't include India, Pakistan, Israel, or North Korea. But the key provisions in the NPT that relates to nuclear disarmament is its Article 6, which requires states parties to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to nuclear disarmament. And on the one hand, you have nuclear weapon states and nuclear allied states like Australia saying that this requirement is sufficient for nuclear disarmament, that negotiations are ongoing and that step-by-step disarmament measures are far more realistic and effective than an immediate and outright ban. But on the other hand, you have these anti-nuclear activists and a lot of other states saying it's been 50 years and we're not even close to nuclear disarmament. Nuclear weapon stockpiles are being modernized and increased. At what point do you say negotiations must conclude and nuclear disarmament must be completed? When does continually dragging out such negotiations become a matter of bad faith? And it was so anti-nuclear activists tiring of nuclear weapon states hiding behind Article 6 of the NPT as one of the catalysts for a ban treaty.
So Anna, some of the nuclear states are arguing that the nuclear ban treaty violates the non-proliferation treaty. Why do they say that, and what's their sort of the basis of their argument?
It's a really good question, and I find these arguments really difficult to understand where they're even coming from. So I don't think that there is any incompatibility between the TPNW and the NPT. And the first and foremost reason for that is that the ban treaty actually has a conflicts clause in Article 18 that sets out how to navigate any potential differences that may exist between the TPNW and any other treaty, including the NPT. So there's a mechanism to resolve any issues that might arise. But if we go and look at the points that the nuclear weapon states raise, one of the concerns they raise is that under the NPT, there is a what we call a verification and safeguards regime. So there's a system set up to check that the states parties to the NPT, and in particular the non-nuclear weapon states, comply with their obligations and that they don't suddenly start accumulating nuclear weapons when they're not meant to. The TPNW also has a verifications regime, and the nuclear weapon states have tried to argue that having these two different verification regimes could create difficulties or could be incompatible. I think the experts, though, that have looked at this have able to see actually they're not incompatible at all. It's completely possible. There are potentially a few differences between the two, and potentially the TPNW's verification regime is a little bit of a higher standard, but that doesn't make them incompatible. It just means that the states that sign the TPNW have to step up a little bit, but that doesn't undercut anything that's in the NPT. The other key point that sometimes gets raised by the nuclear weapon states is that the TPNW undermines Article 6 of the NPT, which is the nuclear disarmament provision in the NPT. And the reasoning for that one is in Article 6, it talks about how all states that have signed up to the NPT have to work towards stopping the arms race, then achieving nuclear disarmament, and then working towards a general and complete disarmament treaty. So three different things. What the nuclear weapon states say is that those three things have to be done sequentially. So first, the whole world has to stop the nuclear arms race, then they have to achieve nuclear disarmament, and then they have to work towards some sort of treaty. And so they argue that having this ban treaty is jumping those first few steps and going straight to the end. I think that it's a very particular reading of Article 6 to require that sequence to occur. And even if we were to say that that's what Article 6 requires, and I'm by no means signing up to that, I think that what we can see is that actually the nuclear ban treaty is a mechanism for achieving all three of those steps in Article 6. So I really struggle to see that it in any way violates or undermines the NPT.
So moving on to sort of how US allies have dealt with the nuclear ban treaty and what it might mean for them, I thought it'd be interesting to link it to some of the, I guess, the strategic situations that countries like Australia find themselves in about and whether they should sign up. And to do that, I think we need to talk a little bit first about extended nuclear deterrence. So, Monique, can you sort of explain what's at stake in this treaty for Australia, or what Australia claims is at stake?
Yeah, so One of Australia's key security policies is extended nuclear deterrence. And so nuclear deterrence is the doctrine that if a state has the capacity to mount a destructive nuclear attack, then other states will think twice about any aggression towards that state. And so the idea is that just having the capacity and threatening to use such weapons will be enough of a deterrence. And then extended nuclear deterrence is where a country with nuclear weapons would conceivably use or threaten to use its nuclear weapons in defence of another country. So to say that Australia is under the US nuclear umbrella is to say that we can theoretically rely on the US to threaten to use its nuclear weapons on our behalf. And so Australia's committed status as a nuclear umbrella state does mean that it can't join the nuclear ban treaty, because the treaty is purposely incompatible with extended nuclear deterrence. The treaty obliges states parties to refrain from assisting or encouraging the use or threat of use of nuclear weapons, and from assisting or encouraging other states from simply possessing nuclear weapons. And so, you know, if we're looking at the term encourage in the treaty, it's generally understood to mean, you know, to allow or to promote the continuance or the development of something. And so it's really not a particularly disputed position to say that a policy of extended nuclear deterrence encourages the possession of nuclear weapons. And so this is one of the key reasons why Australia at this point would not be able to join the nuclear ban treaty without giving up its key security policy of extended nuclear deterrence.
So Monique, this Australia being a confirmed, being confirmed that it's under the nuclear umbrella, what form is that confirmation in? Is this in white papers or sort of public statements, or what's the sort of content of the confirmation, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so Australia has been quite public in its assertion that we are under the US nuclear umbrella in things like defence white papers for a number of decades, I think about 30 to 40 years now, 30 years. And so the interesting thing, however, is so while Australia has been very public in its assertion that we are relying on US extended nuclear deterrence in these defence documents, in public statements, in Parliament, the US has never actually publicly acknowledged that Australia is under its umbrella. There may very well be some sort of secret documents that are not available to the public which confirm this, but there is actually nothing in any of the public domain that suggests that the US has actually confirmed, admitted, yes, we will use or threaten to use nuclear weapons on your behalf. But this doesn't necessarily mean that Australia is not under the nuclear umbrella, because the US has never actually, it's never come out and denied this fact. It's kind of what we call in international acquiescence by silence in a way. And so to that extent, we think now that the policy really most likely has crystallized in international law terms.
Has the US taken the same approach to its other allies, or is Australia unique in its sort of unrequited nuclear umbrella?
In terms of some of its key other nuclear umbrella allies, the US has been quite clear that it is in this extended nuclear deterrence relationship with, say, Japan and with NATO, for example. It's quite clear in the sort of the NATO treaty that it is a nuclear defence arrangement, whereas in the key treaty between Australia and the US, which is ANZUS, there is actually no mention of the word nuclear. So really, it is quite a unique position that Australia has found itself in. But for, you know, better or worse, the last 30 years, Australia has been, you know, quite loudly proclaiming itself under the US nuclear umbrella. The US has never denied this. And so that's where we find ourselves today.
So there's an important military installation that sort of fits into how we should think about Australia's role in the US nuclear weapons activities. So, and that's Pine Gap. So Monique, we don't know much about Pine Gap, but what can we surmise from the what's publicly available?
Yeah, so this is the second way that we see Australia as being involved in nuclear weapons activities, even though Australia doesn't actually have nuclear weapons itself. So extended nuclear deterrence is one. And the other is through these joint defense facilities with the US. And as you mentioned, Simon, perhaps the most well-known one, but even well-known is kind of, it's not very well-known at all, but is the facility at Pine Gap, which is near Alice Springs. And so what we do know about what happens at these defense facilities, a lot of it comes from the work of a group of academics led by Desmond Ball and Richard Tanter. And I would encourage if listeners are interested in what's happening there, they've done an extensive amount of work in trying to document what actually happens at Pine Gap. And so I would encourage listeners to have a look at their Nautilus Institute website, which provides far more technical detail than what I could ever understand. But for our purposes, we're looking at kind of international law and how this ban treaty might operate in relation to Pine Gap. Essentially, the main function of this joint defense facility is global surveillance through signals and intelligence. And so a massive collection of transmissions relayed from satellites, and it's all about sort of intelligence analysis. And most of this information is used for non-nuclear military purposes, but some of this intelligence could be used for nuclear weapons purposes, so nuclear war planning or retaliation. For example, to gain intelligence about nuclear capabilities of enemy states and potentially be able to take action to jam radar defences in advance of a nuclear attack, or to detect empty missile silos, to target for a retaliatory US nuclear strike. And even if this technology and these systems are used for purely defensive purposes, like to aid in a nuclear strike in retaliation for an enemy nuclear attack, any use of nuclear weapons would be forbidden under the nuclear ban treaty. So the question then becomes, is Australia, by virtue of its joint role in the operation of Pine Gap, assisting prohibited nuclear activity for the purposes of the ban treaty? And without going into sort of the detailed interpretive nuances of the term assisting, if the US were to use Pine Gap for any kind of nuclear targeting purposes, it would be quite difficult for Australia to argue that it was not assisting in such activity and therefore, again, in contravention of the ban treaty.
So it's the activity at Pine Gap that prevents Australia from being able to sign up and be compliant with the nuclear ban treaty.
That and its policy of extended nuclear deterrence, both of them, is what we argue.
So you mentioned before in your answer the ANZUS treaty, and that also has a role to play in Australia's approach to the nuclear ban treaty. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of ANZUS and the argument about whether or not ANZUS allows for Australia to join the nuclear ban treaty?
Sure, I'll jump in on this one. So ANZUS was a treaty that was signed between Australia, New Zealand and the United States back in the early 1950s. And it's basically a security pact that has a number of different commitments in it for the different countries who have signed up to help each other on security matters. And one of the issues that's come up in the public debate about the ban treaty in Australia is whether Australia is able to sign up to the ban treaty and still be without violating its obligations under ANZUS. And the basic argument as to why it might be in violation of ANZUS is that it's thought that having extended nuclear deterrence and having the joint facilities at Pine Gap that involve nuclear activity is actually required under the ANZUS treaty. And so if Australia was to give up extended nuclear deterrence or give up the nuclear aspects of Pine Gap, it might be in violation of ANZUS. So that's the argument that's been put. It's a whole lot more complicated in terms of whether that is in fact the case, and I'm happy to get into that if it's helpful, but that's basically been the key argument that's been swirling around the public debate in Australia in the last few years.
And so that's the sort of rationale provided by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade as to why Australia can't sign the nuclear ban treaty?
Yes, it's a position that's put forward by some people in the Department of Foreign Affairs and put forward by different people in different political parties as well. And so Monique and I have taken a really deep look at this issue to try and get to the bottom of it and work out whether ANZUS does actually create problems for Australia or not. So happy to have a quick discussion of that if that's useful.
Yeah, I mean, it might be a bit of a spoiler for your article, but what's your conclusion with what the ANZUS treaty requires? Do you think, is that a sort of widely held position?
So our conclusion is it's complicated. So on its face, ANZUS doesn't say anything at all about nuclear activity. So if you just take a look at the treaty, you'd think it was nuts to be arguing that Australia had to keep extended nuclear deterrence or had to keep the nuclear activities at Pine Gap. However, although the original treaty drafted in the 1950s doesn't mention nuclear stuff at all, the way that international law works is quite strange in many ways for those who aren't in the field, but treaties can change and develop over time. And so if the different countries that have signed up to a treaty start to implement the treaty in a particular way or create other agreements under it, then those can actually shift the meaning of the text in ANZUS. And so something that Monique actually was talking about earlier potentially has changed the meaning of ANZUS. And that is the fact that in Australia's white papers over the last few decades, on numerous occasions, it has asserted that it benefits and is under the US nuclear umbrella because of ANZUS. And so because Australia has repeatedly been saying ANZUS puts us under the nuclear umbrella, ANZUS puts us under the nuclear umbrella again and again and again, and because the US has not denied it or said no, arguably that has been enough to actually create an obligation under the ANZUS treaty, which does require Australia to be under the US nuclear umbrella. That's not, however, the end of the story. So if that is the case, and there are arguments, you know, there are different arguments that can be made about the extent to which that does represent the current position. But even if it is the case, this isn't something that can't be shifted or changed. And in fact, because the very nature, as I've just been saying, of treaties is that they do change and evolve, if Australia can start putting forward different practice and have it accepted by the US, or potentially enter into another form of agreement that clarifies things and gets us out from under the US nuclear umbrella and undoes what's happening at Pine Gap, then that will shift the meaning of ANZUS. And so there's a number of different ways of undoing any potential difficulties that may exist with the ANZUS treaty.
Thanks, Anna. And I think that's some really interesting points there. And I think that it demonstrates some of the complexities of interpreting international law, particularly when you're sort of faced with subsequent practice that clarifies or modifies the operation of a legal regime. So I wondered if we could sort of conclude by asking your opinions about whether Australia should go to the effort of changing the understanding of the ANZUS treaty so that they can join the nuclear ban treaty. Is this something that's worthwhile for Australia and the other US allies that are under the nuclear umbrella or claim to be under the nuclear umbrella?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if Australia and other states want to contribute to making the world a safer place, I mean, even one nuclear weapon is too many. So there's the kind of the altruistic, let's just, you know, keep the world from being annihilated in some kind of future nuclear war. But there's also, I think, potentially a legal argument as well that Anna and I have written before on whether Australia is now perhaps in breach of the non-proliferation treaty, particularly its Article 6 obligation to, you know, pursue negotiations in good faith. Australia was one of quite a few countries to boycott the nuclear ban treaty negotiations, and it has been very clear in its opposition to the ban treaty, largely on the sort of the public reason being given is, oh, we just don't think it's an effective measure towards disarmament. But, you know, if you sort of dig a little bit deeper, you see it is really because Australia is so,
ensconced in the security relationship with the US.
Yes, I was going to say hell bent on its relationship, but ensconced is a good one. I think there's an argument to be made now that particularly nuclear umbrella states, so states like Australia that don't actually have nuclear weapons themselves to start dismantling there's really not a lot of other steps that Australia can take towards nuclear disarmament. And I just don't think it's perhaps a good enough reason now to say, well, you know, nuclear weapons still exist. We're working very, very hard to kind of help these nuclear weapon states disarm through these negotiations, which is clearly, again, like I sort of said before, hasn't really worked in the last 50 years. So I think that Australia is very much at risk of being in breach of the NPT unless it actually takes some steps to perhaps reconsider its policy of extended nuclear deterrence, think about how it can perhaps extricate itself from the nuclear weapons activities at Pine Gap, and really take concrete steps towards joining and supporting the nuclear ban treaty.
Thanks, Monique. I think that's a compelling answer. So not only is it the right thing to do, but Australia is legally obliged, at least under one of its treaties. And so if people wanted to continue reading or learning about the nuclear ban treaty and Australia's position with regard to nuclear weapons, are there particular books or articles that, other than your own great articles, that you would recommend?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff coming out at the moment and some really good pieces. So Stuart Casey Meslin has put out a really comprehensive book that discusses the ban treaty and the negotiations that went on for it. So that's a really helpful text to have regard to. And this is a little bit of a log roll and pushing my own thing, but it's, I've been editing with Associate Professor Trissa Dunworth a book on disarmament law called Disarmament Law: Reviving the Field, and several of the chapters in there go into quite a lot of detail about the development of the TPNW, about some of the different innovative aspects of it. Monique mentioned the victim assistance provisions that are in it, and they get discussed. And also there's a whole chapter that talks about this idea that there might be a conflict between the TPNW and the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and dispels those myths really clearly.
When's that coming out?
It's at the printers at the moment. So I think probably pre-Christmas is going to be pushing it, but hopefully very soon in the new year.
Oh, Christmas present. Too bad. I can also add as well, if people are interested in this area, I would definitely encourage them to look at Richard Tanter's work. He writes a lot of, you know, fairly short blog pieces as well, so you can just Google his name. But Richard's done a lot of really interesting stuff from an international relations perspective on particularly the joint defence facilities and extended nuclear deterrence in Australia.
Very, very good point. We personally owe him a huge amount, but I think Australia in general owes him a huge amount for the work he's done in really discovering and unveiling what's going on.
Well, that's some great tips of stuff to look at, and we'll include links to all of them on the show page. So thanks so much for joining us, Anna and Monique. It's been really interesting.
Thanks very much, Simon.
Thanks heaps.
This podcast was made by the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland Law School. A full list of episodes and links to additional material, as well as our contact details, are available on our website. Just search for Law and the Future of War. This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.